From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! In our last broadcast of the year, we remember the lives of the dozens of journalists killed for doing their job. A new report by the Committee to Protect Journalists calls 2006 one of the most dangerous years for reporters ever. Then we look at the situation in Haiti, where UN forces are accused of killing as many as 17 residents of Cité Soleil. But first, more on the life and legacy of the godfather of soul.
You had the Kennedys, you had the Martin Luther Kings, you had James Brown, you had this, you had that. And out of all of that, James Brown's the only thing still here. Yeah. And everybody ought to be, what does a man have to die before he gets his respect? I mean, it's crazy.
The Reverend Al Sharpton speaking in 1980 as thousands pay respect to James Brown at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. We'll air a never-before-broadcast interview with James Brown on race and the music industry. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. U.S. and Iraqi officials have announced Saddam Hussein will likely be executed sometime this weekend. Saddam Hussein's lawyers have been told to gather his personal effects. Hussein's half-brother, Barzan al-Tikriti, is also expected to be killed. Hussein lost an appeal this week for his conviction for his role in the deaths of more than 100 Shiites in the town of Dujail in 1982. On Thursday, voices including the Vatican, the European Union, and Human Rights Watch condemned the death sentence. Richard Dicker of Human Rights Watch said, quote, "The true test of respect for human rights comes when the human rights of someone who's violated in unspeakable ways the human rights of many millions of people comes into play." Human Rights Watch and other groups say Hussein was denied a fair trial. In other Iraq news, at least 60 people were killed in violence around Iraq Thursday. Dozens of bodies were again recovered from the streets of Baghdad. The U.S. military announced the deaths of another 5 U.S. troops, bringing this month's U.S. toll to 90, second only to 105 service members who died in October. Meanwhile, President Bush emerged from a meeting on Iraq with top officials at his Crawford estate Thursday with a familiar message. The president said he needs more time to work out a plan.
I've got more consultation to do until I talk to the country about the plan. Obviously, we'll continue to work with the Iraqi government. Key to success in Iraq is to have a government that's willing to deal with the elements there that are trying to prevent this young democracy from succeeding. We want to help them succeed. And so we'll continue to consult with the Iraqis. I'm going to talk to Congress.
Vice President Dick Cheney, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and Defense Secretary Robert Gates were all in attendance. The president also received some uninvited guests. Peace mother Cindy Sheehan and 4 other anti-war activists were arrested at a barricade on the president's ranch. Sheehan said she wanted to display a, quote, peace surge as the White House moves towards a troop surge in Iraq. Cindy Sheehan's son Casey was killed in Iraq on April 4, 2004. In Somalia, forces backing the Somali government are in control of the capital, Mogadishu, today, after the retreat of fighters with the Council of Islamic Courts. The Islamic Courts retreated without the firing of a single shot. Pro-government forces include militias linked to local warlords and troops sent by the Ethiopian government. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan repeated calls for the withdrawal of Ethiopian soldiers.
I would also appeal to neighboring countries to stay out of the crisis in Somalia and respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Somalia.
Are you calling for the withdrawal of Ethiopian troops like the African Union?
I have already spoken to the president of Ethiopia about that, and it is essential that neighboring governments stay out of this.
In Israel and the occupied territories, new figures released by the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem show Israeli forces killed 660 Palestinians this year. B'Tselem says that's 3 times more than in 2005. The figure includes 141 children. Nearly half the total dead were not involved in hostile acts. Here in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration has concluded milk and meat from cloned animals is safe to eat and can be sold on the U.S. market. The ruling will face a public comment period before it's up for final approval. Consumer and animal rights groups are already planning a public challenge. This is Carol Tucker, foreman of the Consumer Federation of America.
It will be sneaked into the marketplace, and we at Consumer Federation of America think people should object to that.
In other news, the telecom giant AT&T has agreed to adhere to net neutrality. Net neutrality is the concept that everyone everywhere should have free, universal, and non-discriminatory access to the Internet. AT&T made the pledge as part of its efforts to win FCC approval for its merger with Bell South. Facing a possible court battle over its lack of action on global warming, the Bush administration has agreed to declare the polar bear an endangered species. The move comes after environmental groups threatened to sue the White House for failing to protect the bears. The bear's Arctic habitat has seen declining ice coverage by the year, a decline environmentalists blame on global warming. Despite acknowledging the conditions in the bear's habitats, the White House indicated no plans to curb Alaska oil drilling or impose new limits on emissions of greenhouse gas. This is Greenpeace Research Director Kurt Davies.
They have to account for the voice of the bear and the impact on the polar bear of any actions that are taken. So they have to account for increases in global warming pollution that might be caused by a federal project or by an energy development project. We don't know how they're going to handle this yet, but by law, they should have to account for the inevitable impact of global warming, to global warming, of anything that the government does.
In New Orleans, seven police officers have been indicted over the shooting that left two people dead in the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. The victims, 40-year-old Ronald Madison and 19-year-old James Brissett, were crossing the Danziger Bridge when they came between a gun battle between a group of armed assailants and seven police officers. Madison, who is mentally handicapped, was shot seven times, including five in his back. Police initially claim Madison was armed. His brother Lance Madison denies the police account. Four of the officers have been charged with murder. Announcing the charges Thursday, District Attorney Eddie Jordan said, quote, "We cannot allow our police officers to shoot and kill our citizens without justification, like rabid dogs." In political news, former senator and vice presidential candidate John Edwards announced Thursday he's entering the race for the 2008 presidency. Edwards opened his campaign in the Lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans, one of the neighborhoods worst affected by Hurricane Katrina. Edwards called for steps to fight global warming and end poverty in the United States. He also spoke out against talk of increasing the number of U.S. troops in Iraq.
And it is a mistake. I want to be absolutely clear about this. It is a mistake for America to escalate its role in Iraq. It is a mistake to surge troops into Iraq. It sends exactly the wrong signal to the Iraqis and the rest of the world about what our intentions are there.
Edwards voted to authorize the use of force against Iraq, but now says that was a mistake. In labor news, union workers at 16 plants of the tire maker Goodyear have approved a new contract that'll end their more than two-month strike. Some 15,000 United Steelworkers members in the U.S. and Canada walked off the job in October seeking greater job security and continued health care after retirement. And finally, here in New York, thousands of people passed through Harlem's Apollo Theater Thursday for one last look at the godfather of soul, James Brown. Brown died Christmas at the age of 73. Brown's golden casket was carried through Harlem by horse-drawn carriage and displayed for public viewing on the Apollo stage. Spectators braved five-hour waits to get a final glimpse at the man who revolutionized popular music. Democracy Now! Caught up with some of the fans in the streets outside the Apollo Theater.
I got the feeling. Watch me. I got it. Watch me.
Personally, he was like a role model, because back in them days, you didn't call him James, J.B. Everybody had to call him Mr. Brown, and he made that a fact. Everybody called him Mr. Brown, from the band members to the promoters to the DJs. He was Mr. Brown, and that was the respect that was given to this man back in the day.
When I was growing up, me and my older brother, for about 10 years, we didn't have a father. So a lot of music I listened to, James Brown was also a, what I would say, a motivational speaker, because he had a message.
I used to run away from home from Jersey to come to see James Brown at the Apollo with Jackie Wilson and all of them, and I enjoyed his music and always will, and there'll never be, ever be another him.
Really, every musician owes him a debt of gratitude for his contribution to music, his contribution to the entertainment world, his work ethic, his social consciousness, and I'm here because to me, he's almost like Martin Luther King to musicians. I live in Harlem, and I can't not be here.
I'm here to say my last farewell to James Brown, the hardest working man in show business. The man had enough nerve to tell you that he was black and he's proud. And my little girls are running around there singing. I'm here to give my last respects to the greatest man in the world for singing. He was too black to be white. That's what I liked about him. He really spoke his mind. And I'm here to say, James, go on where you're going. We're going to miss you. The choir in heaven is getting larger and larger. But I'm here to tell you goodbye.
Voices of people on the streets of Harlem yesterday as thousands stood in line to view James Brown. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world on this, our last broadcast of the year, and our 10th year at Democracy Now! Well, on Thursday, as James Brown's body traveled on a horse-drawn carriage across Harlem's 125th Street, thousands of fans followed behind, singing the chorus to his anthem, "Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud." Stores lining 125th Street blared Brown's music and played his videos, while fans danced in the streets and celebrated the life of the musical trailblazer. Brown's body lay in state, or better yet, lay in stage, for 9 hours at the Apollo, the theater where he made his explosive public debut in 1956, forever changing music history. A line to view his body snaked for almost three city blocks. The Reverend Al Sharpton stood next to the open casket, where Brown was dressed in a purple sequined satin suit with white gloves and silver boots and a silver turtleneck. Sharpton addressed the public later in the evening.
Brown, who was 73, died of heart failure Christmas morning. There'll be a private ceremony today in his hometown of Augusta, Georgia, another public ceremony on Saturday officiated by Reverend Sharpton at the James Brown Arena there. He'll be buried later that day. Our colleague here in the firehouse at DCTV, John Alpert, spent time interviewing Reverend Sharpton and James Brown 25 years ago for a documentary about the music industry that he was working on at the time. John Alpert is a documentary filmmaker and the founder of Downtown Community Television. Welcome to Democracy Now! Before we play this excerpt, John, of this interview that you did, can you give us some context for how you started to follow James Brown?
Well, I had never seen James Brown perform before, and my friend said, "John, before you die, there's one thing you have to do, is you have to go see James Brown." So I went up to the Beacon Theater, and there were only 10 people in the audience. The theater was absolutely empty. James Brown started to sing, and he was fantastic, but in the middle of his concert, he got down on his knees like he does, and he began to say, "Folks, look around. The theater's empty. Why? Am I bad? No, I'm the greatest man in show business. The mafia is freezing me out. They won't let anybody come to my concerts. I can't get on the radio. I can't get into concert halls. I can't be in the movies. I'm not on television. But I'm the great James Brown, bum, bum, bum," and he finished this song. So afterwards, I went backstage. I mean, I was so intrigued by this. And there he was sitting under one of those beehive hair dryers next to Al Sharpton, under another beehive hair dryer. I'd never seen Al Sharpton before. And he told me the story, that he wanted to manage himself, he wanted to be independent, and because he was independent, he was getting frozen out by the people and the corporations that controlled the music industry. And I was in the process of being blacklisted myself at that time by public television. I was really angry about this, and I thought, this is one of the greatest performers in the history of America, and he's being frozen out too. So we started to make a documentary.
And you then ended up filming some more of his concerts, interviewing other people in the industry, and what happened to the documentary?
Well, he said, let's fight this. Let's fight it together. And so we began following him around as he tried to get himself on radio. Al Sharpton basically was the general in this war to get James Brown back in front of the public. He was a performer at the height of his powers who was at the bottom of his career because he was being frozen out. And we traced what he was doing for about 3 weeks. And everywhere he went, when he went to eat, when he went to sleep, we followed him around.
Well, we're going to play a clip of the interview you did with James Brown and Al Sharpton.
Tell him I'll be back to Apollo real soon.
We ain't gonna hurt him, brother. Oh, we like, see in the movies, brother.
I love you. Oh, no.
You're like a live folk hero. I mean, it's amazing. You walk one block in Harlem, it's a riot. And any DJ in New York, you got to almost build up an advanced team for a week for anybody to know who they are.
That's right.
And that's amazing. And the thing that you should see in the crowds is it's young and old. There's no age thing. Everybody from all generations know James Brown, know the music. People humming the tunes.
Well, how come we can't see him on TV or hear him on the radio?
Well, you can be, there's a such thing as a man being too strong. And I think that's what has happened, because the system, they can't dress me and undress me on what the people want. I'll never sound like nobody else. I ain't gonna do that to myself. I'll sound like myself. Even if you don't like me, it'll be my fault. It won't be because somebody else sound bad and I sound like them.
It's hard for me to understand, right? You come up there, people go crazy, obviously very popular guy. Radio stations could make money, they played. TV stations could make money if they put you on. The record companies, if they promote it, how come they're not playing?
The people that got them stations are not the people in the streets that don't know. And what happens is when guys like you start putting this on the tube, the advertisers are gonna see who the real people are. See, the people in the streets that have always bought the records are not the people that work in these companies. And a lot of people felt that they just hired people that was black, that they were hiring people that knew, and that's not necessarily true.
Now, they hired people that went to college and took up marketing, and but didn't take up people. It's different when you know people. No reason for them kids to be out there doing bad when there's some blacks that don't want to do nothing for themselves. Now, they got to all do something for themselves now. I come out of prison as a little junior delinquent. And I've been up doing it ever since. And it, like, every time I get a chance, I'm in the black community talking to the kids. I'm doing things. We see these black businesses that's successful, and they won't help the blacks. Let's put them out of business.
Tell us the story. I mean, what happened? And this is something that everybody might be interested in knowing about. You tried to become independent. What happened?
The system crushed me.
Give me some examples.
Well, number one, I couldn't get into television. I couldn't get into movies. The record company were cutting my records and wouldn't promote them, wouldn't even send them out. Why did all the black-owned record companies fold? Why? Because they were forced out by the big ones. Every one. And not just the black-owned ones, all the small. I think you got two independents right now. A good friend of mine, Henry Stone in Miami, Tone Records, he's being forced out. He's a good friend of mine, you know. Forced him out. And he's not black, he's Jewish. Where he's being forced out. Name an independent record company. You name one.
Is there one?
That's what you're saying, is there one? But when you were a little kid running behind James Brown, there was 300,000. There's not any now.
So if you're independent, you can't get records out?
Not a one.
And how about if you're independent, can you get on the radio?
Independent artist.
Let's say you walked in with the tape.
No, never get it on. And they're supposed to play so much local stuff. That's in the thing. They probably don't play no local records.
And how about TV? Could you get on TV?
Totally out of the question. I tried to record Try Me. Nobody would accept it. I cut it on a Coca-Cola crate. On a Coca-Cola crate. And come here, in a radio station I recorded it. So I come to New York, and NOLA Studios was on 49th and Broadway at that time. I recorded 9 acetates that you play outside in. They played backwards then. You ever seen that before? Well, those records were there. Outside in. Did you know that I took these records. The record company wouldn't let me record no records. That King Records said I didn't have nothing else left. So I took the records and took them to radio stations myself. And they played them. and the demand became great.
Never been a leading black figure in no walk of life in this country that knew the business that they was doing except him.
They never let him learn the business. And I learned it because I paid my way.
Mm-hmm. When I made a mistake, I went back the next time, I knew what it was, I didn't do that no more. I'd have 15,000 people in a building, excuse me, sir. Yeah. I'd have 15,000 people in a building. And I say, you know, I could have 20,000 there. And everybody would be happy with that. I'd be happy. But I'm not worried about what I did right. I'm worried about what I didn't do right and what I could have done. It's about what you can do better. Like, it's not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country.
The problem with James Brown being played on a radio station like BLS in New York, we talked the other day, getting ready for your South African tour. They said the problem in South Africa is not the whites or the blacks, it's the colors. That's the problem in the United States.
He's a color man.
It's the colors. He's a color man. They are ashamed of being black, and James Brown brings it all to the surface. So the only niggas run with a James Brown records on is niggas that's really ashamed of being black. Because you either got to be black or white when James Brown's singing. You got to be what you are. The only people that can't take a James Brown record is unnatural people. Because they're ashamed of what they are.
They're colored.
That's right. So and all them niggas over there is ashamed of what they are, so they try to act like they something else, so they try not to play what they really are and hope nobody will notice what they are. And they don't realize the people they're trying to beat like dig what they are in the first place. The struggle right now is the struggle has always been. It's just that now people are telling the truth about it. The struggle is against what's wrong. It's not black or white, like Mr. Brown said.
That's right.
It's wrong. The struggle is against wrong. Black people get free when we admit that blacks can be a problem too. I mean, it was blacks that sold us to white folk in the first place. Yeah. And until I deal with the seller and the sellee, I'm going to be so cool. If you look at black history or American history, the last 20 years, you had the Kennedys, you had the Martin Luther Kings, you had James Brown, you had this, you had that. And out of all of that, James Brown's the only thing still here. Yeah. And everybody ought to be, what does a man have to die before he gets his respect? I mean, it's crazy. If something, God forbid, would happen to James Brown, they'd be selling him at every hot dog stand in New York. And here he is, and they won't play it on WBLS. I mean, so a man almost has to become a martyr to get appreciated in this country. And there's something wrong with the people that build the dead and bury the living. I mean, it's crazy.
When are we, as a people, going to recognize that we have a duty to ourselves, you know? When are we going to put our own pants on, you know? When are we going to be the one to set the example for our kids? I'm not saying all that the whole race of people don't do it, whether it's black or Latin or Oriental or what. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying, when do we as black people, which I'm very much aware of, start doing something massively for ourselves? I don't care what people say, I must respect the Jewish people. I must respect the Italian.
That's the model we should emulate.
I must respect
the Jewish model.
Well, I respect the Jewish people,
especially
the Italian.
The
I respect the Germans. I respect all them people. I respect anybody to stay where they at. And that's the difference. Then you got to respect the Oriental people. Because they really come from behind. See, so I respect these people.
James Brown and Reverend Al Sharpton at the Plaza Hotel in New York City being interviewed by John Alpert more than a quarter of a century ago. We'll come back in our conversation with John Alpert in a minute. have a funky good time. That's James Brown, filmed by John Alpert and Karen Renucci, our general managers. They were working together more than 25 years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, John Alpert, the filmmaker who was doing this documentary on race and the music industry and the mob. John, why did it never get done?
It didn't get done because about 3 weeks into the filming, James signed a very lucrative contract. And he decided that maybe he'd rather play along with the folks and put some money in his pocket than fight them, because he was really getting frozen out. I mean, you just never heard him on the radio during those days. It was astonishing, because when I grew up, I was a little bit before your time, he just electrified our high school. And he was the guy that set the cultural tone. Everything's the Beatles. It wasn't the Beatles, it was James Brown. And every single black kid in our high school was transformed by his music and by the message.
And as I mentioned in my column, the Daily News Today, telling the story of what happened with you, then I said, in the end, I guess James Brown chose, the godfather of soul, chose not to challenge the godfathers of crime, and especially in the music industry. But who among us, 25 years later, can say he made the wrong decision? Because at least the music that so many of us have appreciated of his was able to get out, and who knows what might have happened if he had made that challenge at the time and made the great film that you were hoping to make, right?
We might never have heard from him again, except probably when he died, we would have venerated him like we're doing now, you know. And it's affected everybody. What the folks at home don't know is that every day after the show, Amy does the full James Brown split. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, and you know what she does? Come on, do the mic throw, Amy. Come on. She really does it.
Confusing me with Juan, John.
Well, no, Juan does it during the breaks. And who hasn't imitated James Brown at some time or other and tried to do the dance and things like that?
Well, I'll tell you, yesterday
in Harlem.
Happening. Yesterday in Harlem, outside Bobby's Records, all along the street, the pride, just the thousands of people who lined up at the Apollo. He started there, right, 1956, and they said he came home. And pride was the word over and over again used. Juan, we'll link to your column at the New York Daily News at democracynow.org. Final words, since people will never see, or perhaps someone will pick up this documentary you eventually do on James Brown, just filming the concerts that you filmed, and we're going to end more with the song.
It was amazing to see these songs that had really become part of everybody's own personal culture, seeing them performed and just seeing the uniqueness that made James Brown who he was. All over the world, people were transformed by him. When I told my friends I was going to be on TV, you have fans all over the world, just like James Brown has. It's hard to believe that Amy's as big as James Brown in some places. But I know in Havana people are watching today, and when I said we're going to show James Brown, people from the presidential office are watching. I have people in Moscow that are watching today. It was just amazing to be there, but to know that he could be frozen out, that because he wasn't given the mafia the split they wanted, he was finished. And to some degree, whether it's the mafia or big corporations, this same type of control continues. That's why you're independent. That's why I'm independent. But it's tough.
John Alpert, thanks so much for being with us and for agreeing to air this never-before broadcast interview that you did in 1980.
Yeah, we were just kids then, weren't we? Wasn't that great?
At the Plaza Hotel, and also walking with going in the car with Sharpton and Brown as you drove through Harlem as they were talking at the beginning.
It was amazing. It was like riding around with a deity. And people, when they saw him, they almost bowed down. I've been with kings and queens before. That's what it was like.
Last night when I was talking to people like Amin on the street selling buttons and other people, they were saying the last time Harlem felt like this was when Nelson Mandela was in town. Well, this is Democracy Now! We'll go back to a clip of...
Come on, do it. Just once for the audience. Come on, do the throw.
We'll go back to a clip. Juan, do what you always do.
And
with James Brown.
While this is on break, Amy will be doing the full James Brown split. You just won't see it at home.
Okay. We'll just show you James Brown, which is what you want to see and hear. This is James Brown in concert. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, today on our last broadcast for 2006, Democracy Now! Takes a look at the number of journalists killed this past year. A new report by the Committee to Protect Journalists finds 2006 to be one of the most dangerous years for journalists ever. 55 journalists were killed in direct connection to their work. In Iraq alone, violence claimed the lives of 32 journalists. It was the highest yearly death toll recorded by the organization so far in Iraq or, in fact, any country in a single year.
Murder was the leading cause of journalist deaths around the world. The CPJ report determined that less than 15% of journalist murders result in convictions of their perpetrators. Frank Smyth is with us now, the Journalist Security Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Frank. It's great to have you with us. In fact, Frank, you yourself, before we talk about this year, were a victim of a kidnapping, your colleague killed during Desert Storm. Is that right?
Well, we were actually captured embedded with Kurdish rebels trying to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and were held, weren't kidnapped necessarily, but captured and held incommunicado before being released.
And could you tell us, in summary, what some of the most troubling findings of this year's report were?
The most troubling finding is, number one, is that the death rate in Iraq is increasing, rising to 32, which is a record so far since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. And in addition, 28 of the 32 journalists killed in Iraq in 2006 were outright murdered by insurgent or other irregular forces, and almost all of them were Iraqis. So we started seeing murders a few years ago in Iraq of journalists, but now 61% of journalists being killed in Iraq have been murdered, and that's a disturbing and rising trend.
I also noticed in your report that, as you mentioned, overwhelmingly most of the journalists killed were Iraqis. Does that mean that basically there's been an enormous pullout of foreign journalists from the coverage, or is it that the Iraqis are being targeted more?
I think it's both. I think you have less foreign correspondents operating in Iraq, and those that are operating are rarely venturing beyond the green zone areas near the green zone to avoid being kidnapped, as was the case with Jill Carroll. At the same time, you've seen an increasing number of journalists being targeted merely for doing their work, whether they're working for U.S.-backed media, Western media, or independent Iraqi media that's emerged in the past few years.
And I'd like to ask, in terms of those Iraqi journalists who were killed, were most of them working for Iraqi news organizations, or were these a lot of Iraqi journalists who have since been hired by foreign news organizations?
Most of them in 2006 were working for Iraqi news organizations.
The number of Western journalists, of course, in Iraq has gone down with the dangers. In the last few years, though, there have been also a number killed by U.S. troops, like, well, what Reuters described as one of the leading conflict cameramen of our time, Mazen Dana, killed by U.S. troops outside Abu Ghraib. Then there was the Al Jazeera reporter Tariq Ayoub. The U.S. military shelled the area around the Al Jazeera office where he was on the roof. He was killed. What kind of tone do you think that set early on as we lead up to this point where the bulk of the deaths are as a result of, well, you write in the Committee to Protect Journalists, insurgents?
The incidents involving U.S. forces, in particular the shooting of Mazen Dana, was especially disturbing because he was shot at relatively short range in a situation where it called into question the rules of engagement. We protested and asked for clarification from the Pentagon about that shooting in particular. And the Pentagon eventually did a comprehensive report and investigation of the shooting, which exonerated the soldiers involved. But the report itself encouraged the Pentagon to review its own rules of engagement so that U.S. forces would be made aware of the right and presence of journalists to operate on the battlefield. And the Pentagon has never acknowledged whether or not it's followed its own recommendations. But we've sent a number of letters to former Secretary Rumsfeld and other officials encouraging them to follow that report's recommendations and to make U.S. troops aware of the right and presence of journalists to operate on the battlefield.
Of course, perhaps the most famous U.S. attack on journalists was the shelling of the Palestine Hotel, where hundreds of unembedded reporters were. And two cameramen were killed, Taras Prostyuk of Reuters, he came from the Ukraine, and Jose Coso. This was right the day before the U.S. forces took Baghdad and pulled down that statue of Saddam Hussein. Just in the last few weeks, a Spanish judge has ruled that the U.S. soldiers involved in the killing of Jose Coso could be subpoenaed or indicted.
There are two issues there. One is the issue of the soldiers that operated on the ground. And the U.S. military also did an investigation of that incident. Those are the few cases where the U.S. military has conducted its own investigations and, again, exonerated the soldiers on the ground. But the issue that remains unresolved is why wasn't information about the fact that that hotel was filled with journalists communicated to troops on the ground? The U.S. military's own investigation never looked at the command and control issues that were illustrated by that tragedy.
Frank Smith, I'd like to ask you about other countries in your report. I think you list the Philippines, Afghanistan, of course, Colombia, which has traditionally been one of the most dangerous countries in the world. Could you talk about some of the major cases that you covered that occurred this year there?
Sure. One of them, in the Philippines, we've seen a number of murders for many years, most of which have gone unresolved. Overall, one thing to point out is that 61% of the journalists killed in Iraq since 2003 have been murdered. The actual worldwide level of murders is higher. 70% of all journalists killed worldwide over the past 15 years have, in fact, been outright murdered. And the Philippines now is near at the top of the list. You also have had cases like Hayatullah Khan, a journalist in Pakistan, who disappeared for a number of weeks before his body was discovered. And he had been murdered, we believe, in retaliation for his work. So we've seen journalists...
Frank, can you talk more about that? That was very significant, what he was investigating.
Well, he was investigating a U.S. military airstrike, according to family members and his colleagues. He then disappeared. We made inquiries attempting to find out who might have him. It was very difficult to get any cooperation, and eventually his corpse was discovered. He had been murdered, and we believe that he was killed in retaliation for his work, and his investigation into that airstrike in particular looks like the most likely cause.
Can you talk about the Russian journalist who was killed most recently this year that leads up to the latest scandal that we're seeing unfold now in Britain with the former Russian spy?
Well, the journalist, most recent journalist killed in Russia is one of about a dozen journalists that we believe have been murdered in retaliation for their work in recent years, one of them being the former U.S. journalist and Forbes correspondent Paul Klebnikov. But you've seen a number of journalists being murdered in Russia, in particular investigative journalists, whether they are foreigners or Russian journalists. And the impunity rate, so far none of those crimes have been resolved. And overall, worldwide, over the past 15 years, the impunity rate for murdered journalists is about 85%, unfortunately.
Now, in terms of Colombia and Latin America, it appears on the surface that things are improving in some of those countries in terms of the some have had very high rates of murders of journalists. Could you comment on that?
Well, to say it's improving in a place like Colombia, after so many journalists have been murdered with almost complete impunity over the years, you don't need to murder that many more journalists to keep journalists from wanting to investigate difficult or sensitive matters, especially human rights abuses or ties between military and paramilitary forces that have been responsible for a great deal of violence against journalists. So the fact that the number of Colombian journalists being murdered is not as high now as it was 5 or 10 years ago isn't necessarily indicative of much of an improvement. I think you still have the lingering effect of the residue of that previous violence. And in Colombia, there are very few investigative journalists left that are really looking at those kinds of issues. And the few journalists that are left, Ignacio Gomez, Holman Morris, had themselves been subject to death threats and have periodically been forced to leave the country.
Back on the issue of Russia, in the case of Anna Politkovskaya, the Russian journalist who was killed, leading investigative journalist and critic of the state, specifically President Vladimir Putin, shot contract style in her Moscow apartment on October 7th. Can you talk more about that and the holding of the state responsible?
Well, that was a case that remains under investigation. It's not uncommon. And it's unclear exactly what the motivation was, but certainly she did enterprising, groundbreaking work in investigating abuses in Chechnya involving Russian and other forces. So we believe that her work in Chechnya may well be responsible or what led to perpetrators to then murder her. But that kind of gangland-style, mafia-style assassination is quite common in Russia like it is in many other nations. And certainly, whether or not it involves security forces is still unclear. But the problem is that very few of those kinds of murders of journalists in Russia, as in many other places, end up being resolved.
Frank Smyth, I wanted to ask you about a story that didn't get very much coverage this week. We heard a lot about one of the last acts of the UN Security Council and imposing sanctions against Iran. But on that same day, last Saturday, the UN Security Council approved an unprecedented resolution that condemned attacks on journalists and urged countries to protect journalists. Can you talk more about that act of the UN Security Council?
Yes, Amy. This was a resolution that was brought forward by the International Federation of Journalists, a journalist federation of unions. The International News Safety Institute, of which the Committee to Protect Journalists that I work for is a member of, and also the European Broadcasters Union. And it was an effort to pass a resolution that would underscore the right and duty of journalists to be able to operate in armed conflicts, covering armed conflicts, without fear of being targeted or victimized by state or other forces. And one of the most important parts of the UN resolution was to underscore in one of the operative paragraphs that broadcast facilities, that media facilities must be considered civilian entities and may not be considered military targets unless there is some specific reason to target them in a military manner. And coming in the wake of U.S. attacks involving Al Jazeera, the Kabul Bureau, in 2001 in Afghanistan, that Ron Suskind reported earlier this summer was a deliberate attack, according to his sources, which he did not name, on Al Jazeera. Coming in the wake of those kind of attacks, this resolution and that particular language is very important, and it underscores that media outlets must be considered civilian entities and not be targeted for military purposes.
Frank Smyth, again, I want to thank you very much for being with us of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Just put out their report. The 2006 tally in Iraq is the highest in a single country since the Committee to Protect Journalists was founded in 1981 of journalists killed. The second deadliest year was 2004. Again, that was journalists killed in Iraq, only matched in 1995 in Algeria, both of which saw 24 journalists killed. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. Mustamist, Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
In Haiti, more than 1,000 people marched through the streets of Port-au-Prince Thursday to protest the presence of U.N. forces in the country and to call for the return to power of the democratically elected former president Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide. Aristide lives in exile in South Africa after his ouster in a U.S.-backed coup nearly 3 years ago. Thursday's march followed the deaths of as many as 17 civilians who were shot by U.N. troops in the capital city's impoverished city Soleil neighborhood last week. Demonstrators expressed outrage at what witnesses called indiscriminate firing by U.N. forces. Many suggested that the U.N.'s intention was to suppress popular support of Aristide and his Lavalas political party.
The U.N. has denied charges that it fired indiscriminately, saying it was targeting armed gangs involved in recent kidnappings in the city. And the control of the U.N. force, Cité Soleil, has been plagued by kidnappings and crime. Well, to discuss the situation, we're joined by Levinsky Pierre-Antoine and Kim Ives. Levinsky is a Haitian human rights activist, head of the September 30th Foundation, an advocacy group for coup d'etat victims. Kim Ives is an independent journalist who specializes in Haiti, and he'll also be translating for Levinsky. We thank you both for joining us. Levinsky Pierre-Antoine, what happened? Were you in Haiti at the time, or were you here when this happened last week?
Yes, I was in Haiti.
You were in Haiti?
Yes.
Tell us what happened.
So I'm going to speak in Creole. Yes. Ça passé en Haïti.
What happened in Haiti?
C'est poursuite de guerre, d'un génocide contre population pauvre.
It's a continuation of a war of genocide against the poor population.
Et ça, c'est manifestation de ça nous relayer, même si nous n'avons pas voulu entendre ça, de la lutte des classes.
And that is an expression, in fact, of the class struggle in Haiti.
Et il se trouve que Nations Unies, par le biais de la MINUSTA,
by what is called the MINUSTA,
et trouver les complices de la guerre contre pauvre en Haïti.
Is an accomplice of this war against the poor in Haiti.
Nous qu'à suivre ça qui t'est passé dans Cité Soleil 6 juillet 2005.
We can see what happened in Cité Soleil on the 6th of July 2005.
Qui s'est qu'a passé chaque jour dans Cité Soleil avec soldats Nations Unies qui a tué monde pour rien.
What happens every day in Cité Soleil where the soldiers kill the poor for nothing.
Et ça qui s'est passé là, 21 pour 22 décembre 2006. Là.
And what happened this past 21st, 22nd of December of this year.
Et campagne qui gagne contre pauvre en Haïti, côté à mettre mauvais étiquette sur yo.
This campaign against the poor in Haiti, where they give them some kind of pejorative name.
Et Jean, soldat Nations Unies, a cherché résoudre problème insécurité qui gagne dans le pays. Hein.
The way that United Nations soldiers are trying to resolve the insecurity problem in the country.
So même si c'est un problème qui est réel.
Even if this is a real problem.
So mais façon que on résout le problème là,
the way
est inapproprié.
Is not appropriate.
Now, you know, I'd like to ask, in all my years as a journalist, in terms of seeing how the United Nations operates in peacekeeping missions, I've never seen such periodic reports of the U.N. troops involved in aggressive, violent actions against populations, as there has been in Haiti over the last few years. Do you any sense of, on your part, why the U.N. is playing such a role in Haiti, so different from what it's done around the world?
Demandé est-ce que vous pouvez expliquer pourquoi ça Nations Unies tellement des problèmes en Haïti, tellement des rapports de problèmes en Haïti.
Le problème, là, c'est que les Nations Unies étaient supposées en force de stabilisation, en force de maintien de la paix.
The problem is the United Nations is supposed to maintain peace. It's supposed to be a force of stabilization.
Mais en fait, c'est
la
présence des soldats des Nations Unies.
In fact, the presence of the United Nations forces.
C'est expression de poursuite de coup d'État 29 février 2004 là.
It's just an expression of the continuation of the 2004 coup d'État.
Parce que tout le monde qui était fait crime dans le pays à la fin de l'année 2003.
Because all the people who were doing crimes at the end of 2003.
Tant que Guy Philippe,
like Guy Philippe.
Et tout l'autre ancien militaire, yo.
And all the former military.
Yo pas gen ken problème, yo an dan pays.
They don't have any problem. They're just circulating freely in the country.
Et même moun kap victime, je ne je dis à deux soldats Nations Unies, yo.
But the people who are victims today of the United Nations forces.
C'est compatriotes nous qui en dans Cité Soleil et l'autre quartier populaire, yo, qui étaient campés en face Guy Philippe.
Our compatriots who are in Cité Soleil and the other popular quarters who stood up to Guy Philippe.
Donc, MINUSTAH pas qu'à jouer rôle maintien de la paix parce qu'ils n'ont pas neutre.
Because the MINUSTAH cannot play the role of peacekeeper because they're not neutral.
MINUSTAH being the UN.
The UN, yes, it's the mission to stabilize Haiti.
Nous passons tout dans l'analyse que nous faisons de situation, hein, gain trop influence de ambassade américaine.
And we feel in the situation there's too much influence from the U.S. embassy.
So, représentant spécial secrétaire général des Nations Unies, Monsieur Edmond Mullett.
I'm the special representative of the United Nations, Edmond Mullett.
Et que dans compréhension par nous, en fait, la MINUSTAH représentait pour nous en Haïti une force d'occupation.
And to our mind, the United Nations represents an occupation force.
Qui a poursuivi répression contre la population,
which is pursuing repression against the population.
Affaibli institutions nationales, tant que la justice, tant que la police, au lieu pour être renforcée.
And weakening the institutions of state, such as the police and justice, instead of reinforcing.
Et préparer mise sous tutelle du pays d'Haïti.
And putting the country under tutelage.
The BBC just did an exposé on the rape and abuse of kids in Haiti by the UN forces. Before that, we did the Wayne State University report on the massive number of rapes in Haiti, and the specifically also looking at UN forces. Now the UN forces say they went into Cité Soleil in this last shooting because of the gangs there and the kidnappings. Your response, Levinsky Pierre-Antoine.
C'est pas réponse pour chercher gang dans Cité Soleil que MINUSTAH a cherché parce que.
It is not that they're looking to look for gangs in Cité Soleil doing kidnapping.
Phénomène insécurité avec kidnapping qui gagne dans le pays.
The phenomenon of security and kidnapping in the country.
C'est un phénomène purement politique.
Is a purely political phenomenon.
Et un dernier acte de kidnapping qui était gagné dans le pays que.
One of the last acts of kidnapping in the country was.
Sénateur Andrés Richer était dit les victimes c'est un montage, c'est un coup de théâtre.
Was a guy called was a senator called Andrés Richer and this was a complete piece of theater.
Et il était fait pour être capable justement cibler Cité Soleil.
And they did this precisely so that they could target Cité Soleil.
Et by impression que. Il y a bataille contre insécurité.
Impression that they were trying to fight against insecurity.
Mais dans l'autre zone, côté qui gagne insécurité, tant qu'au Cafoufeuille avec la métier manchette.
But in other areas where there's insecurity, such as in Cafoufeuille, where you have the little machete army.
Ni la police nationale, ni soldats MINUSTAH n'ont pas fait rien dans la zone ça.
Neither the national police or the MINUSTAH soldiers did anything to stop that.
What power does the legally elected government of Haiti have now to, can't they just request that the UN troops leave? Why haven't they?
Pour qui ça le gouvernement haïtien n'a pas demandé pour troupes Nations Unies aller?
Gain actuellement en campagne que nous a entreprendre et qui a commencé
presently there's a campaign that we've undertaken
entre 1er janvier 2007 et 15 février 2007 pour justement mander Conseil de sécurité des Nations Unies pour mettre fin à mission MINUSTAH en
which
Haïti.
Will go between the 1st and 15th of February to demand that the Security Council remove the UN troops from Haiti.
Le côté gouvernement pas prend responsabilité pour empêcher que génocide ça que Nations Unies complice de l'IA fait en Haïti.
Haitian government has not taken its responsibility to stop the genocide in Haiti.
So, nous-mêmes, nous-mêmes, dans la population, dans le secteur démocratique, là, nous avons pris responsabilité.
In the democratic sector, have taken our responsibility.
I'm looking at the press release from the United Nations, and they say they're working with the security forces of Haiti. And in their press release that was released last Friday after the killings in Cité Soleil, they say the operations have resulted in the arrest of 24 kidnapped suspects and the liberation of six victims. A number of weapons were also seized. Final comment.
It's
Dernier tuerie qui fait dans Cité Soleil là, monde qui était mort.
Last killing that was done in Cité Soleil, the people who died.
C'est pas monde qui était gain zam nan main yo.
We're not people with guns in their hands.
Te gain femme enceinte, te gain ti monde nan yo.
There were pregnant women and children among them.
Gain selon sa journaliste et témoin qui était sur place rapporté, te gain entre 30 et 40 monde qui mort.
And according to journalists on the ground, there were between 30 and 40 people who died.
Et nous-mêmes nous pensons qu'il y a 60 et 80 monde qui mourit.
But we think it's between 60 and 80 people who died.
Parce que même la population, les a courir, yo prend monde qui tombe yo pour aller avec yo.
Because the people, when they run, they take the people who fell to run with them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Levinsky Pierre-Antoine, Haitian human rights activist, head of the September 30th Foundation, just came up from Haiti. And Kim Ives, thanks very much for joining us. That does it for today's broadcast, the last of the year. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Maté, Lee Burek, Jen Yutes, Anna Noguera. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are engineers. Special thanks also to Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Jerome Bourgeois, Tyshawn Black, Angela Alston, Uri Galed, Samantha Chambly, and all the staff that makes this broadcast possible. Isis Phillips and Karen Renucci, Julie Crosby, Neil Shabada, Megan Whitney, happy birthday, Mick Nicky Smurl and Mark Waters, Nick Marsilio and Dennis Moynihan, Michael Castleman and Mike Kimber, Robbie Karen, Angie Karen, Alberto Cortez, David Rice and Jillian O'Connor, Peter Hune, Hugh Gran, Edith Penty, Luai Abuzaspa, Rebecca Silver, Andres Canteras, Chuck Skurich. We want to thank all of you because you are at the heart of this broadcast, the largest public media collaboration in the country as it continues to grow in this country and around the world. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We wish you a very happy new year.